Chapter 8.
Who the hell is this?
Am I talking to Oliver Higgins?
Yeah, I'm Higgins. My secretary said you were calling for Sergeant Tracy.
That's right. I'm not going to tell you my real name. You can call me Jane Doe. Look, I know you're after him. If you try to trace this call, it won't help you because I'm calling from a public phone, and I'll be long gone before anyone can get here.
Give me a break, kid,
Higgins said.
I don't give a damn what your real name is or where you are, and I'm not after Tracy. I don't give a damn about where he is either. I've got more important things to worry about.
Like a nuke falling on New York, you mean?
Yeah, like that. Look, I don't have a lot of time. Tell Tracy that I called the club because I was trying to help him out. Linda Tellerman didn't give him away. I had her arrested and shot up with pentothal. I didn't want her going on the air with this and starting a panic. And if you're smart, you'll keep your mouth shut about it too. Tell Tracy that he got the job done. We believe him. I've spoken with Cord myself, and he's already contacted the president with his demands. We've got about 48 hours before Cord goes public with the threat. We're on it, okay? Tell Tracy if he wants to come in to call this number in about an hour and ask for Dr. Stone. If he doesn't trust me, tell him to stay low and sit tight. Whatever happens, he'll know about it by Friday.
What are you going to do? She asked, but Higgins had already hung up. She replaced the receiver on its hook and bit her lower lip, then picked up the receiver once again, dropped in a coin, and started to dial a number she never thought she'd call again. They had been arriving all throughout the day, dribbling into the warehouse individually and in small groups. Several trucks had already gone out to LaGuardia, ferrying them out. This would be the last load. There were so few of them, so pathetically few. Gang members, hired thugs, retired strike force personnel, retired agents, retired gang members, for Christ's sakes. Private security guards who had once been on the NYPD, active strike force personnel who could be spared from duty, perhaps a couple of hundred all told, if that. And with few exceptions, they were a pretty sorry-looking lot. Higgins stood by the door alongside Jake Hardesty, captain of the strike force. ICE had already gone out with the first load. Outside, in the street, a small SCAT helicopter sat waiting to fly them out to LaGuardia.
It's hopeless,
Hardesty said grimly.
We haven't got anywhere near enough men. They'll all be slaughtered.
We've still got a unit of volunteers coming out from the base in New Jersey, Higgins said. And Steele's supposed to be coming out with them people from the Brood Enclave. He sent his pilot back. He's riding out with them.
Great, said Hardesty Riley. We're going to try to take on Cord's entire command with a few hundred street kids and old men and a handful of bikers, soldiers, cops, and agents.
He shook his head.
We might as well throw in the towel right now.
We can't, said Higgins. We're committed. We've got no choice. The last truck pulled out of the warehouse. Hardesty sighed heavily.
What the hell? He shrugged. I was getting hemorrhoids from sitting on my ass behind a desk, an ulcer from too much lousy coffee, and a spare tire from too many goddamn fucking jelly donuts. I just as soon get shot as wait for my damn arteries to close up.
Higgins smiled. Look at it this way, Jake. We're with a couple of old war dogs past our prime. This here is what you get, and what you call the last hurrah. He paused briefly. You got a wife? Kids?
Nope!
Said Jake, his gruff voice like gravel, rattling in a can.
Never got around to it!
Me neither, Higgins said. I suppose you could say I've got a girl. We had some plans, nothing real definite. She doesn't know I'm going out with the assault force. He glanced at his watch. She thinks we're flying out together in about 3 hours. My security chief's got orders to personally get her out of town, even if he has to tie her up to do it. He snorted. It probably wouldn't have worked out anyway. Hardesty grunted. Higgins glanced around at the empty warehouse. Come on, he said. Let's get the hell out of here. The battered old Jeep bounced along the potholed road through Big Thompson Canyon, heading towards Estes Park. Tracy sat in the back, cradling his battle rifle in his lap, while KC sat in the front passenger seat. The driver was her brother, Jace Carter, who had told him that his friends called him JC.
Yeah, I know, Karen had said. KC and JC. And my oldest brother is Tommy Carter, whose friends call him TC. My old man is Cash Carter, CC, and my mom is Mary Jane Carter.
Don't tell me! MJ, right?
You got it. We're a regular alphabet soup.
Dad thought you were stoned when I told him what you said, said JC. Then he heard on the news about Linda Telemann being arrested by government agents and about your friend being wanted for desertion and shooting down an army chopper. He said, since when does the army send out helicopter gunships to bring back one deserter? I think I'd better have a talk with that boy. And he sent me out to pick you up.
That's the first time my father's acknowledged my existence in about 4 years, Casey said wryly.
Why?
Asked Tracy. She stared at him and grimaced.
Why the hell do you think? Dancing in the club is the first decent job I've had since I came to Denver. Imagine what I must have done before. Besides, I sort of burned my bridges when I left.
Let's not talk about that now, her brother said, his eyes on the road.
He was in his late 20s, slim, blonde like his sister, and dressed in a plaid shirt, jeans, baseball cap, and work boots.
I think you're being a little hard on Dad. And Mom cried when you heard you were coming home.
You're kidding.
No, I'm serious. She's been blaming herself ever since you left. She wanted us to go and look for you, bring you back. But Dad said no. He said you made your choice of your own free will, and we had to respect that. If you wanted to come back, that was up to you.
Good old libertarian Dad, said KC with a sour grimace.
Tracy felt a little awkward sitting there listening to family business. He didn't know what had happened to make her leave her home, and he didn't really want to know. He didn't care what she had done before. All he knew was that she had trusted him and helped him based on nothing but her instincts, and she had taken him in when he was in trouble and fed him and taken risks for him and loved him, and when he told her that he loved her, she had laughed and said she didn't need to hear that, but he had meant it. He'd never been to Estes Park before, but when he saw it, he decided that whatever family trouble Casey might have had, it must have been pretty serious to induce her to leave such a lovely place. Nestled in a little valley at the entrance to Rocky Mountain National Park and ringed by majestic mountains, Estes Park had once been a resort town that survived primarily by catering to the tourist trade. Old Victorian buildings were interspersed with log homes and more modern construction, along which were some rather tacky fake Swiss chalet-type malls and storefronts, but not even their tastelessness could detract from the overall effect. They drove past the airstrip and the hangars the survivalists had built, then through the town, heading toward the stately Stanley Hotel, which stood on a bluff above the town, its columned portico looking out over the valley, affording a breathtaking view of Long's Peak, its summit shrouded in clouds. The Stanley was a grand old place, built by the man famous for the Stanley Steamer, one of which still stood in its lobby, and immortalized in fiction as the Overlook Hotel by a celebrated horror writer who had stayed there. It was still a hotel, though there were rarely more than a few guests, usually business people from Denver there on a conference or just to relax and get away from the city and soak up some rustic atmosphere. The town was now an enclave of survivalists and libertarians, rugged individualists who gave the place a paramilitary atmosphere. Stores that had once sold Indian jewelry, rugs, and paintings now dealt in various types of ordnance and military equipment. Window displays held AKM rifles, Viper machine pistols, M16s and M60 machine guns, law rockets, grenades, semi-auto pistols and revolvers, and reloading presses and supplies, with components ranging from a wide assortment of powders and full metal jacket or military hardball rounds to lead-molded bullets and jacketed hollow points, flechettes and sabotaged shot rounds. Surplus military vehicles were plentiful upon the streets, from Jeeps and Hummers to small armored personnel carriers and even a couple of M1 tanks, as well as pickup trucks, dirt bikes, and even horses in Western tack. It looked as if the small resort town had been invaded by a horde of motley mercenaries with a heavy sprinkling of rednecks and cowboys. People on the streets wore Western clothing, complete with six-gun rigs, tiger-striped fatigues and paratrooper boots, lumberjack outfits and jogging suits. There were several small manufacturing concerns in Estes Park, notably the American Small Arms Company that produced, among other ordnance,
the 9mm, Viper machine pistols, and the polymer ceramic 45 Demon semi-automatics. Like Texas, Estes Park wasn't really a part of the Union, but unlike the Lone Star Republic, it had never formally seceded. The residents of the ultra-capitalist settlement simply refused to pay any kind of taxes, though there was a fund maintained for voluntary contributions to the federal government, which most of the business concerns contributed a part of the profits to. The government of Estes Park consisted of a town council and a peer review board. There was no police department, but the citizens volunteered their time to serve on the town posse, which was led by the town marshal, the only full-time law enforcement officer in the enclave. There was no drug problem, since narcotics of all types were sold freely over the counter to anyone who wished to purchase them, though there was a town ordinance against public intoxication, applied at the discretion of the town marshal and the peer review board to control people whose use of intoxicants disturbed the peace. Violators were fined and or required to perform community service. Habitual offenders and felons were not sentenced to prison, but were completely ostracized. They found themselves unable to work, unable to make any purchases of any sort, and unable to socialize. They soon left the community. The seal of the Estes Park Enclave, its flag, and the masthead of its newspaper all bore the image of a coiled rattlesnake prepared to strike and the legend Laissez-faire. That flag, black and red on a yellow background, flew over the Stanley Hotel as they pulled up, signifying that the town council was in session. They went through the lobby and turned right, entering the meeting room. The meeting room was casually informal. There was a bar set up alongside the left wall, and comfortable chairs placed around in a sort of loose circle. There was no dais and no table or podium. There were about 30 people present, men and women. The men all looked relentlessly healthy and casually self-possessed. The women all looked like free-spirited mountain girls and terrorists. Even the older people in the room had a natural pioneer sort of glow about them. Tracy had a feeling that at any moment they would either start repelling an Indian attack or launch into a square dance. One of them, an attractive, long-haired brunette in faded jeans, western boots, and a checked flannel shirt, came running up to them and threw her arms around KC.
KC, oh honey, I'm so glad to see you!
She started crying.
Hi, Mom.
Tracy was a bit taken aback. The woman looked more like her older sister than her mother. She didn't look a day over 30. She hugged her daughter tightly, and KC seemed a little awkward about it, as if she hadn't been prepared for the reaction. A moment later, one of the men came up to her, a little nervously it seemed, and said,
Welcome back, KC.
There was a moment of uncomfortable silence.
Hi, Barry.
KC averted her eyes. She swallowed hard.
How are you?
I'm fine, KC. How are you?
There was a tension between them.
Okay, I guess.
Barry and I are married now, KC,
her mother said.
Oh,
Casey said in a small voice.
Well, congratulations.
What's in the past is in the past,
her mother said.
Okay, can we just start from that?
I didn't think you'd ever want to see me again,
Casey said.
We've both been blaming ourselves ever since you left,
Barry said.
I really hope you'll stay this time.
Tracy felt like an outsider. He was an outsider, but a moment later, Casey's mother turned to him and said,
You must be Reese Tracy.
She said. She held out her hands.
Welcome.
Thank you,
Tracy said, taking her hands somewhat awkwardly.
We'll be starting the meeting as soon as cash arrives, she said. In the meantime, can I bring you a drink?
A beer would be nice, said Tracy.
Coming right up.
Barry introduced himself briefly. They shook hands, and then he excused himself and moved away. Casey stared after him for a moment. She had a strange expression on her face.
What was all that about?
Asked Tracy. And the moment he said it, he regretted it.
Not that it's any of my business, of course.
Old wounds, she said. She turned to face him and took a deep breath. I never thought they would forgive me.
You don't have to tell me.
I don't want to keep anything from you, Trace, although you probably won't think much of me when I tell you. I found out that Mom was having an affair with Barry. I hated her for it, and I hated him. I couldn't tell Dad, but I wanted to hurt them. It's a long story, but I'll make it short and not very sweet. I got him stoned without his realizing it and seduced him. He was so wrecked and he didn't even know what the hell was going on. And I set it up so Mom would walk in on us.
She grimaced.
I was 15.
Tracy stared at her, astonished. He didn't know what to say.
Nice, huh? I knew she'd freaked out, which she did, but I figured it would break them up, which it didn't. Mom called me a whore. moved out of the house and refused to see me or talk with me again. Dad, he wouldn't even get mad. He said that whatever problems him and Mom were having were because between them and none of my business. He said that he could understand my feeling hurt and angry, but that what I'd done was a pretty ugly thing, and that I should go to them and try to work it out. I couldn't believe he said that, and I wasn't about to go and apologize. So I just split.
She glanced at him and shrugged.
So that's the whole sordid story of how I wound up on the Denver Strip. Actually, there's more after that, but I figure you've probably heard enough. Anyway, it's been nice knowing you.
People make mistakes, he said, knowing that it sounded rather lame. Sounds like everyone in the situation made their share. They seem willing to forgive you. Your mom was right, you know. What's past is in the past. It's now that matters.
She sighed. God, why couldn't I have met you 5 years ago?
He smiled.
Like I said, it's now that matters.
Her mother came back with a couple of beers for them.
Casey, there's your father,
she said, looking towards the door. The man who came in looked like a Santa Claus out on a camping trip. Like Casey, his hair was so blonde that it was almost white. He wore it longish in the back, and he had a huge white blonde beard. He was of medium height, about as tall as Tracy, but he outweighed him by at least 100 pounds. He was very stocky, with a huge barrel chest and a bit of a paunch, although he wasn't really fat. He came straight over to them.
MJ,
he said, giving his ex-wife a kiss on the cheek. Then he turned to KC.
It's good to see you, pumpkin.
He gave her an affectionate hug and a kiss.
I really missed you, honey. Welcome home.
She started to tear up.
Oh, Daddy.
It's okay, he said. You're home now, and that's all that matters.
He turned to Tracy and held out his hand.
Cash Carter.
Reese Tracy, nice to meet you, sir.
Well, thank you for bringing my little girl back home, he said.
Well, I didn't really bring her, sir. She brought me.
No matter. Anyway, we can talk later. Casey told me a little about what's happened, and a little was enough to ruin my whole day. What I'd like to do is start the meeting and have you fill everybody in. Can you do that?
Yes, sir.
Good. Now let's get the show on the road, then.
Higgins glanced at his watch. They had less than 36 hours. Maybe they could extend that if the president called court and capitulated. Keep him from going public and starting a mass panic. Jesus, he thought, the government's about to fall and nobody knows about it but a handful of frightened people. He'd spoken to the president over a secure radio channel shortly after he'd arrived in LaGuardia. The man had sounded awful. Well, what could he expect? He wanted to know how things were progressing, how many people they had, what the status of the mission was. The mission. What a joke, thought Higgins. He was standing in a dilapidated hangar on the grounds of a deserted airport, once one of the largest in the country. But now the airstrips were cracked and buckled with weeds growing up through them. And from this unlikely place, they were going to launch a mission, a certain suicide attempt by a pathetically inadequate band of soldiers, young street crazies, and old men. They had gathered together a fleet of sordid vehicles, jeeps and 4x4s, and trucks that had been hurriedly equipped with an armor plate, pulled all the ordnance they could get their hands on from the armories, drugs and money to pay off the hired so-called talents, and three huge C-17s from the Newark base. All things considered, it was a miracle that they had done this well. They had assembled several units of volunteers drawn from troops stationed in the area, and there were the agents and the cops, but it still wasn't enough. Not nearly enough to take on the troops that Cord had under his command. But still, there was a chance. A chance that if they could manage enough of a distraction, Steele could get through and manage to get to Cord. Or was he only kidding himself?
What if he launches the missiles the moment the attack starts?
The president had said in an agony of indecision. It's possible, sir, but I don't think he'll do that. He'll probably take one look at our so-called assault force and start laughing himself silly. But if it allows Steele to get through, he'll be laughing out of the other side of his face.
What if Steele doesn't get through?
The president had said, his voice strained.
My God, how can I take such a chance to the lives of all the people in this city?
You're not taking that chance, sir. You're going to capitulate. You're going to give in to Cord's demands and do exactly what he tells you to do. You don't know anything about this.
Jesus, Higgins!
If we fall, sir, you'll hand the government over to Cord. There'll be nothing else to do. I know Zach Cord, sir. He may have slipped a cog or two, but I honestly don't believe he really wants to launch the missiles. And I don't think he will, unless it's the last option he's got left. If it comes to that, he'll do it, but not until his back is up against the wall.
But that's exactly what you're talking about doing,
said the president.
Putting his back against the wall.
Not really, sir. We're just gonna try to get him to turn it in for a short while. And if we're lucky, while his back is turned, we might be able to stop him. If not, then he's won. And if he's won, he won't need to launch the missiles. Higgins had tried hard to make the president believe that. He only hoped that he believed it himself. He stepped outside for a breath of fresh air and a cigarette, which he decided was an oxymoron if he ever heard one. Hardesty came out with him.
Got the jitters too, huh?
He said.
Where the hell is Steele? Higgins said tensely.
He'll be here,
said Jake Hardesty.
How long does it take to drive out from Montauk anyway? Said Higgins with exasperation. Why the hell couldn't he have flown back?
Probably to make sure that the people actually came, said Hardesty with a grimace.
You never know what the hell those bikers are going to do.
I don't know what the hell these people are going to do either, Higgins said, glancing back toward the hangar. I wouldn't be surprised if they just grabbed the stuff we've got here and took off.
If they tried, my men would shoot them, and they know it.
Most of them don't even know what the hell is going on, said Higgins.
What did Ice tell them?
Just that we needed some heavy people to take on some renegade troops.
Well, that's true, isn't it?
Yeah, but they don't know who the troops are, said Higgins. The moment they find out who they're really up against, they're all liable to turn tail and run.
Hardesty shrugged.
So don't tell them. Wait until we get to Wyoming, and they either have to go for it or walk home.
You should have been a general, said Higgins.
Linda Tellerman came up to join them. She was wearing a borrowed pair of Strike Force fatigues that were slightly larger on her. Her cameraman was right behind her.
This is crazy, Higgins, she said. About half these people are total head cases. Cord's troops will chew them up. It'll be like the charge of the Light Brigade, assuming they don't all just drop their weapons and take off for the hills the minute the shooting starts.
Then maybe you'd better stay behind, said Higgins.
Hey, forget it. We had a deal. I don't make a stink about being busted and shot up with truth drugs, and you take me along to cover the story. Don't try to back out now.
I'm not trying to back out, Miss Tellerman, said Higgins. But this was your idea, not mine. After what we put you through, I figured the least I could do was accede to your request. But once we get to Wyoming, you're on your own. I can't guarantee you any protection.
I didn't ask for any, she frowned. What is that, thunder?
Great! That's all we need, said Higgins. That hangar roof is full of holes.
That isn't thunder,
Hardesty said, gazing out toward Grand Central Parkway.
It's bikes! A lot of bikes!
The sound grew rapidly louder until it became deafening. People started to come out from inside the hangar to see what it was, and then they saw them winding down the road like some kind of impossibly huge serpent. The brood, riding in formation.
Jesus Christ, said Higgins. I don't believe it. Look at all of them.
There must be at least 500 bikes,
Hardesty said, amazed. The air throbbed with the sound of straight pipes. It sounded like an earthquake.
Mikey, get a shot of this, said Linda to her cameraman.
The lead bikes entered the airport and came across the buckled tarmac heading toward them. The rider in the lead looked like Death himself, dressed from head to toe in black leather, pale as a ghost, with long white hair flying in the wind, his arms up high on the handlebar grips. Behind him and to the right rode Peacemaker, the Uncle Sam's death head flag of the brood, flying from a pole bolted to the rear of his bike. And next to him rode Steele, wearing a leather motorcycle jacket with snakes colors over it. They passed in front of the astonished crowd gathered in front of the hangar, and the lead three bikes pulled up. Snake held up his left arm up, made a circling motion with it, and the bike circled around, peeled off, and started to line up on the tarmac. There seemed to be no end to them. The roar of their engines was so loud, Higgins had to shout to make himself heard to Hardesty, who was standing right next to him.
Look at this!
He yelled.
They even brought their own damn fuel!
Several old tanker trucks painted with the club's colors brought up the rear of the huge formation, as did a small fleet of panel trucks and vans. They pulled up behind the ranks of motorcycles as Peacemaker stood beside his bike, directing club as it formed up. Then he held his right arm up and pumped it up and down several times. The bikers all revved their throttles as they stood in place, and the sound made the entire hangar shake. Then they shut down. "Damn," said Higgins. "We've got us a fucking army." As the bikers started to dismount, Steele came up to them.
"Sorry," he said with a shrug. "This was the best I could do."
Higgins grimaced. "You did all right," he said. Then Steele glanced past him and saw Ice and Raven coming toward them, both wearing black Strike Force fatigues.
"Raven!"
He looked at Ice.
"What's she doing here?"
Ice shrugged.
"Lady got a mind of her own."
"That's right,"
she said to Steele.
"And don't give me any arguments about it. I came along on the assault of the Borodini Enclave, and I'm going along on this one."
"This is hardly the same thing," said Steele. "We're not going up against a bunch of mobsters. We..."
"I said I wasn't going to argue,"
she interrupted.
"Jake's got some female Strike Force officers back there, and I could shoot a gun as well as any of them."
She glanced at Linda.
"And if she's going, so am I. Besides, if you think I'm going to sit around and wait for some damn nuke to fall, or hear you got yourself blown up into scrap metal, you can just forget about it."
Snake and Peacemaker came up to join them.
"You let your old lady talk to you like that?"
asked Peacemaker.
"I talk any fucking way I please,"
she snapped.
"You got a problem with that? You bring her right here."
And the next thing the biker knew, there was a commando knife in her hand and it seemed to appear out of nowhere. Peacemaker grinned.
"Fucking A," he said, slapping Steele on the back. "I like her. She can ride with me." "She rides with me," said Steele.
He turned to Higgins and Hardesty.
"Gentlemen, I'd like you to meet the chief officers of the Brood. Snake, President, and Peacemaker, Sergeant at Arms."
He turned to the bikers.
"Oliver Higgins, CIA, and Jake Hardesty, Chief of the NYPD Strike Force."
Higgins held out his hand. Snake took it and reversed it in a biker handshake. Hardesty simply grunted. Snake glanced at him and smiled thinly.
"I brought my own Strike Force," he said.
"I can't thank you enough for coming," Higgins said to Snake. "Damn, I think we might just pull this off."
"You think?"
said Snake. "Look, I don't know exactly what arrangements Steele made with you people," said Higgins, "but whatever the deal you concluded was, I just want to reassure you that he was fully authorized to..."
"I'll tell you what the deal is, man,"
Snake interrupted.
"The deal is we got our own supplies and our own ordnance. The deal is we get to rumble Cobra Force. The deal is you don't tell us squat. You just get us there, then get the fuck out of our way. Got it?"
Higgins raised his eyebrows and glanced at Steele.
"That's the deal,"
Steele said. "Got it," Higgins said.
"Righteous," said Snake. "Now what can you tell us about the layout?"
"Come on inside," said Higgins. "We've got a scale mock-up of the base setup. We'll run the briefing, then load up the planes. We're leaving tonight."
"Mr. President," said Cord.
"All right, General,"
the president said, his voice heavy.
"You win. There's nothing we can do to stop you."
"I'm glad you're being intelligent about this, sir," said Cord into the phone. "I don't think you'll regret it."
"I'll regret it very much,"
the president said.
"But you've left me no other choice. You're holding all the cards. Tomorrow morning, I will appear before the Congress and officially announce that I'm surrendering the government to you. I imagine that announcement will cause something of a riot, but once I've explained the situation, I don't think Congress will buck me on this."
"I want that announcement televised," said Cord.
"As you wish."
"And I want to address the nation immediately following your speech," said Cord. "Have the network make arrangements to send a crew up from Denver."
"Very well. You realize, General, that an orderly transfer of authority would involve a very complicated process. In order to minimize the difficulties, I've assembled a committee of experts to fly out and advise you. I hope you will accept them."
"Send them out," said Cord. "But just in case you might have any ideas about an assassination, Mr. President, be advised that your people will be checked out very
thoroughly.
I understand that.
Good.
I imagine you'll want my formal resignation.
I don't think that will be necessary, sir, said Cord. At least not right away. I intend to use the existing government bureaucracy for the time being, but rest assured that I intend to slim it down. The country's going to be run efficiently. For now, I'd like you to remain in office as my chief executive.
I'm flattered,
the president said wryly.
And what title do you intend to use?
I think the title Provisional Military Governor would be appropriate.
Not Caesar,
said the president. Save your sarcasm, sir. It's wasted on me. I have no desire to see this country become a totalitarian regime. But until we can get things fully back under control, it will be necessary to institute martial law. Hard times require hard measures.
Yes, I suppose they do,
the president said.
Well then, unless you have any further instructions, I had best go and get work to work on my speech. It won't be a very easy one to make.
I'm sure you'll do fine, sir, Cord said. I'll be watching. Goodbye.
Goodbye, General.
Cord hung up the phone and turned to Colonel Tyler with a smile. That's it, he said. We've taken control of the government without even firing a shot.
Congratulations, sir.
Thank you, Seth. The president said he was going to fly out a committee of advisors to help expedite the transfer of authority. And there will be a news crew coming up from Denver. Alert security and make sure they're all thoroughly searched when they arrive. They'll have to prepare quarters for them. And call a full formation for Reveille tomorrow morning. I want to announce our victory to the troops. We'll have a busy day ahead of us, but right now, I think we deserve a drink. Will you join me? Thank you, sir. I'd feel honored. Cord poured them each a whiskey. He raised his glass. Tyler did likewise. To the new order, said Cord.
To the new order,
Tyler echoed. They drank, and as they emptied their glasses, the Matrix clone, which had sped through the phone lines from the federal building, started hurtling through the power lines of the base. It was about an hour before dawn. The van bearing the news crew from Denver slowed as it approached the three large 4x4s blocking the road ahead of them.
Shit. That's all we need,
the news reporter said to her driver and camera operator. Raiders. They'll steal our van and all the equipment and leave us lying in the road. Don't stop, for God's sakes. Go around them.
I can't go around them, said the driver. They've got the whole damn road blocked off.
Great, said the reporter. Maybe they'll only rape me and kill you.
I don't think they're raiders, said the driver as he saw the men approaching them in the glare of his headlights. They're wearing uniforms. They look like soldiers.
He slowed to a stop. Steel, Ice, and several armed soldiers in battle fatigues came up to their van. Steel opened the passenger side door.
Would you get out, please?
He said.
Look, we haven't got much money.
Take it easy, miss. We're not raiders. We're government agents. Please step outside.
Look, I don't know what this is all about, she said as she got out of the van, but we're from Channel 4 in Denver, and we're on our way up to Cheyenne to cover an important story. The president is going on the air in a few hours, and we've been asked to provide a live hookup to...
I know all about it, miss, said Steele. That's how we knew you were coming.
He glanced at the driver.
You the cameraman?
That's right.
Let me have your jacket.
What is this? Asked the reporter. What's going on?
He's going to show me how to work his rig, said Steele. Then he's going to get in that truck over there and go with these men. And I'll be coming along as your cameraman.
Whoa, wait a minute. Who the hell are you and what's this all about?
The name's Steele, ma'am. And this is a matter of national security. We're operating under the direct orders of the President of the United States.
Wait a minute. Donovan Steele? The cyborg?
That's right, ma'am. What's your name?
Sheila Blaine.
Well, Miss Blaine, like I said, this is a matter of national security. I'll brief you fully on the way to Warren, but I'll tell you up front that this is going to be dangerous. I'd really much rather have you go along with these men and let someone take your place. But as a local news reporter, your face is liable to be known. And that'll help us get in. If anything goes wrong, I want you to tell them that I forced you into this at gunpoint. You understand?
She stared at him, then glanced at the soldiers.
What's happening? What are you going to do?
We're going to try to prevent a military coup, said Steele. I'll fill you in on the way, but right now we haven't got much time. Now show me how to use that camera.
End of chapter.